The Irish Times Inside Business podcast in association with Davy. It's amazing what you discover when you really listen.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business, a podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Laura Slattery, standing in for Ciarán this week, and on today's show, after the collapse of Topshop retail group Arcadia, I'll be joined by Jo Farrelly, the Irish woman who was the marketing director of Topshop during its heyday. She'll be telling us what it was like to work with Chairman Philip Green and what she thinks has gone wrong for the brand. And later I'll be talking to Fiona Redden of the Irish Times about the state of play in the property market after a rise in mortgage approvals. But first, COVID-19 has been the final blow for Philip Green's fashion empire, Arcadia. While its shops are still trading for now, administrators have begun a desperate search for buyers to protect as many jobs as possible. The group's woes predate the pandemic, however, with brands like Miss Selfridge, Wallace and even Topshop overtaken in recent times by stronger, savvier rivals, both on the high street and online. So what happened to the confident, cool Topshop that its many fans loved at the turn of the millennium? With me now is Jo Farrelly, former marketing director of Topshop. Welcome to the podcast, Jo.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you were part of the team that led Topshop to great heights. But can you tell us first how you came to join it and what your opinion was of the brand at the time?
Yeah. Yes, I remember it very vividly. I was actually... Obviously, I was educated in Ireland, and then, like many people from here, we all kind of leave and go abroad for a while and maybe work elsewhere. So I actually, having finished business studies, whatever, in Trinity, ended up in Belgium working for Levi's, Levi's Europe. And if you like, that was really where I kind of honed my sort of skills as a sort of a brand kind of, you know, insider, brand kind of expert. Because one of the things that Levi's was really good at doing at the time, certainly, you know, in the late 80s and the 90s, was they really kind of trailblazed in terms of, you know, brand advertising and all their ad campaigns. And just, they were very fastidious about how to build a proper brand. But one of the things that they weren't so good at Levi's was being a retailer. And that's where, if you like, myself and Jane Shepperson from Topshop kind of, both our minds kind of met. I wanted to learn more about retailing and she wanted to learn more about how to build a brand. So basically, in 2000, Jane first of all became brand director in 1999, and you know, she had been already in Topshop for, you know, I think it was ever it was her first job, in fact. So I think she was there for about 15 years as and working really as a buyer. But really, she knew instinctively that what she needed to do to take Topshop out of the doldrums was to actually build a brand and to try and make it cool. And I basically interviewed with her, and I was also at the time, I just felt it was a real opportunity. I mean, Topshop was actually known as being Flopshop, a name. I've seen that as a headline this week. But certainly it was really naff, you know, it was a really naff place to shop and it was kind of embarrassing. But at the same time, there's this kind of great energy and great potential with that brand and also as a retailer. And really at the time, brands were becoming retailers and retailers were becoming brands. So basically we both saw the opportunity that, you know, really, Topshop was ripe to kind of make it into something much more covetable than it was, and that journey started in sort of 2000, and that's what we did. We worked together for 7 years, you know, and that was our mission. But it was a very exciting. It was very much about reinventing that brand, and at the time Jane said, you know, I just want to make it cool. I want to make it cool, and I was like, well, what do you think is cool, you know? And she was like, well, French Connection. I don't know if you remember French Connection, but at the time it was like the FC UK, you know, French Connection UK. And I remember going to her saying, well, I think we can do better than that, you know?
Yes, the FC UK was a slightly risque.
yes. And at the so time it was groundbreaking, if you like. But really, we just knew that we started that journey and I can tell you a bit more about that.
Just to go back in time, just briefly, the start of Topshop was in the 60s, in the basement of the Peter Robinson chain, which was owned by the Burton Group at the time. But over those decades, it had come to the point, as you said, where it was treading water, effectively. And Jane Shepherdson, brand director, she felt, as you did, that there was a lot more to do and that could be done, and
potential to win so many more hearts and minds of young shoppers. So tell us then, how did the vision come about? You thought you could do better than French Connection. What were the first things that you did?
Well, really, at that time, in terms of Topshop, to their advantage, they had about 300 stores. And that was a huge opportunity in terms of that alone. That just real estate and having that amount of miles, if you like, of free advertising is the way I sort of saw it. And then it was what happened inside those doors was the problem. And that was also the opportunity. So, Topshop had been very good at sort of selling, fast fashion and kind of like cheap clothing, really. But people were actually embarrassed to shop there. So it wasn't something you were proud of. It wasn't something that you'd sort of boast about. We really knew we had achieved something when literally people were validating their sense of style by the fact that, this might be from Prada, but this is from Topshop, And it was that kind of became cool not to be dressed head to toe in luxury brands, but it became cool to mix both your high street and your kind of more designer pieces. That was almost the essence of what we were trying to kind of create, because it was this sort of moment, that kind of zeitgeist moment of when suddenly it felt right that, because there was this whole logo mania thing going on at the time. It was like that Burberry time where people were sort of head to toe and the Prada, all the big kind of flagship stores were opening in terms of the designer street. But suddenly people wanted something that was much more, democratic. And that was really what we set about creating, was this kind of fashion democracy, to treat people, no matter what your bank balance was, to treat everybody equally, to excite and delight everybody that walked into our store. Whether you were, just getting your first paycheck, or whether you were like a schoolgirl, or whether you were like a celebrity that could like afford to buy the entire store. We didn't really care. We wanted to treat everybody the same and make sure that there was this kind of VIP culture, if you like. And that was the other thing, that we just made people feel really special. But in terms of setting out, the brand vision, we started off by saying, as I said, it was very important about, a brand can be anything that you want to be, but the important thing is to decide what that is and then set about very clearly in pursuing that direction, pursuing that vision. And it became very clear to me, when I came in for 6 months and sort of did a bit of due diligence on the brand and sort of assessed as to whether or not there was any potential there. And certainly it seemed for me at the time that, very much Topshop's vision was very simple. We decided to become the fashion authority. And that was what we set out to do. Lots of other youth brands were involved in music, or they were involved in different things. We decided to be all about fashion and to be the fashion authority. And then we set about, basically a pathway to actually achieve that goal. And that was something that was, we were on a mission to do that over a course of years. But it very much was about, making sure it started with the product, making sure that our product was absolutely the best product that we could offer for that price. Always we had this big commitment to the customer in terms of, you really wanted to attract those customers who were very authoritative in their kind of fashion, who actually wanted something a bit different. And so we created a number of new collections to do that. From, we were the first high street brand to show on London Fashion Week, for example. And another big part of what we were also about was, you can't sell all these jeans and t-shirts if you don't give something back. And giving something back to the industry was hugely important for us at the brand. And so we started off particularly supporting the up-and-coming fashion designer. And then that was kind of where the seed was sown for a huge program around London Fashion Week, the new generation designers, all these programs that we developed hand in hand with, the fashion industry at the time. And that's very much what we were about. But ultimately, at the core of everything that we did, it was about the customer and always trying to exceed their expectation, always treating them as being with utmost respect. There was lots of little touches that we did at the brand that just made sure that we had that customer loyalty. And I think that's kind of what stood us apart from the rest. You know, in the kind of mid 2000s, if you like, the mid noughties, that was really where Chop Shop had won over the rest of the high street, because we had this insider fashion loyalty, and people couldn't understand it.
I mean, I remember the reviews from the first London Fashion Week. I think it was the first anyway, and they were positive. And over the years after that, it became expected that that Topshop would be there, that they belonged there. It wasn't going to be a novelty 1 year and then they're gone. You were going to be back and you were going to have something interesting to show.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, behind the scenes of that, I mean, the reason why we were invited to the table, because at the time it was sort of unheard of to do something like that. It was only for the privy of designer designer brands. But the reason why we were invited to the table to that was because for a number of years, if you like, when we started out sponsoring Graduate Fashion Week, and then we created a program which was called New Generation, and they were the new generation of fashion designers. And, you know, that was all about providing not just money to the next generation of designers, but also we would very much partner with them and give them space in our store to sell their collections and also get that exposure of what it's like to be a retailer and to get firsthand experience of, you know, building your business. Because, you know, those designers, I mean, they are very much the heartbeat of the industry. So we felt very strongly with that. But then we also had our own Topshop Unique, which is our own designer collection, and that was our own line. And it was very much about setting about to sort of prove the point that actually, because Topshop was really known as copying other brands initially, and that was another thing that we needed to kind of really shake off. I mean, that was from a brand equity point of view, we needed to demonstrate that wasn't necessarily the case. We had an amazing design team headed up by Nick Passmore, so the people inside Topshop were very, very talented and very creative group of people.
And it was all going really very well. You were adding customers. I was certainly one of them at the time.
Great.
And I remember Topshop Unique, we always had interesting kind of silhouettes and things that maybe that were slightly daring, but, you know, not too out there. And I know in the noughties, when sort of day dresses kind of came back in a big way, I used to get mine in Topshop. But something happened in 2002 that sort of changed the course of the company and the brand eventually. So what were your thoughts when you heard Philip Green was going to buy Arcadia, Topshop's parent?
I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of like one of those moments, the same way as we all know what we were doing when, you know, we got the news that Lady Diana died, or, you know, these mega moments. I actually just remember sort of pressing freeze frame almost in our life when we heard that Philip Green actually might be buying Topshop. We couldn't actually believe it. At the time, we really thought there's no way Stuart Rose would actually even sell it to him. But we were kind of disbelief initially when that rumor happened. It was a defining moment for the brand. I mean, 2002, it sounds quite early on when he bought the brand, but actually the impact of that maybe wasn't felt until, you know, a couple of years after that, really. So initially, I mean, it was at the very end of 2002. So we managed to just kind of stave him off, keep him away from Topshop for a number of years, really, until it became unmanageable. And then we knew we needed to depart, because it wasn't going to work out otherwise. I think initially when Philip bought Arcadia, you know, he was buying it very much as a property play, and he was actually attracted to Dorothy Perkins and Burton's, who between them had about 500 doors, you know, in terms of stores. And that's what he was after. But it was only when he actually had taken on the company that he was absolutely couldn't believe this little gem, the crown of Topshop and the performance of that brand. And it was sort of, you know, a rate of sales or a rate of return on sales that he had never really witnessed. And he couldn't really understand how it was so profitable. And he became sort of obsessed with wanting to associate himself with that brand and associate himself with building that brand and that success. And I think, like a lot of business people, when they actually get to this sort of extreme success in terms of monetary success, the one thing that they all crave is to have that endorsement in terms of their reputation. And I think that's something money can't necessarily buy. And I think Philip really wanted to gain that endorsement from the fashion industry and to use Topshop as a vehicle for him to get that endorsement amongst, you know, the fashion editors and celebrities and whatever else. And I think that's very much, he not only became interested in the brand, but he actually tried to really become the face of the brand. And you and I know, I mean, that is not a good strategy for any business owner, for any brand particularly. You know, it's got to be about the brand first. And so, that was sort of the beginning of the demise, as far as we could see.
So he was very keen on celebrity partnerships in particular, wasn't he?
Yes. Tell us
about the conversation that you had with him that sort of almost accidentally led to the Kate Moss.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I should say, so in terms of the fact that, you know, the reason why Topshop was so successful was no doubt because we had a strategy, and that strategy was very clearly set out, and it was a plan that we were following, and part of that, there were some core principles that we believed in. And one of the core principles was that we would not pay celebrity. So we were about this fashion democracy. We were about, and that was working very well for our brand. So it was just a point of principle. There was many other brands that were paying celebrities huge amounts of money to appear in their ad campaigns. We just felt we weren't about that. We'd much rather spend that money in actually giving it back into the industry, supporting the up-and-coming designers who have got no money at all. Some of them are sleeping on the floor of their studio just to get their collections out. You know, we felt we had a responsibility as being a brand like Topshop on the high street to do that for the industry. So actually the whole celebrity thing, I mean, that was just it's just not a new idea. I mean, it's boring. I mean, it's like, I mean, we were at the advantage that celebrities were shopping with us, and we would still never even tell anyone they were shopping with us. And some of the best kudos for our brand was, I mean, one of the times I was reading Vogue and I read Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, was boasting about the fact that she shopped in Topshop, you know. So we very much kind of were the unexpected sort of high street brand that we would treat you with privacy and respect, and we wouldn't talk about, you know, what our customers were doing. But so basically, in some ways, so Philip coming barging in with this sort of, okay, come on, let's do a celebrity collaboration. And we were like, yeah, okay, but you know, that can't be at the cost of not doing these other things, in terms of supporting the designers, or you can't take money away from that to do this. So for many years, I just try to kind of keep him away from meddling in the brand. And so did Jane. And both of us would have hours and hours of discussions with him, many quite animated, as you can imagine. But basically, you know, no matter who he would suggest, I would just go, no, not definitely not right for the brand. So we were very much the brand guardians, you know, so nothing. And he kind of respected that to some level, but he found it hugely frustrating that he just couldn't. He just wanted to get, he was desperate to get his hands on, desperate to get sort of right up front and central to that brand. So we were like, no, not going to work. Okay. And I said, no, it's not cool. It's not cool. And then he goes, well, who is cool? And I said, well, I'll tell you who's cool. And I said, Kate Moss, she's pretty cool. Thinking in my head, well, there's no way he's going to come out Kate Moss. I mean, there's no way she's going to, you know, be paid off by Philip. I really naively thought that was, you know, going to be the case. And anyway, he came back in, you know, a few months later and just said, Joe, I've got something for you. I've got Kate Moss. And I was like, oh no. To myself, I was like, oh no. So not because, by the way, Kate Moss was fantastic and she, you know, was a big supporter of the brand. It wasn't that. And she was a great customer of the brand. And we even had something called the Kate Moss vest because she came in and bought so many of them. They were absolutely the kind of vest she liked to wear. But it was just, we just knew it was the beginning of the end, nothing to do with Kate Moss, but because that was Philip's way in. And if you look at any of the photographs or any from that moment on, I mean, it's the beauty and the beast. So there's like photos, there's Kate and Philip, you know, and it's just not that, I mean, it's just not that relevant for, you know, a young 20-something customer or a young kind of cool Hoxton girl, you know, who wants to, you know, find something kind of alternative in her wardrobe. It just took, it basically from that moment, it just made our jobs very difficult because, If you're spending all this money on celebrities, it becomes very hard to negotiate. deals in other areas. So
yeah, I remember those photographs of Philip Green with Kate Moss on his side, or at least I think I remember them, but they've been in the press so much lately as well. Maybe what I'm remembering is the fact that they were shown again yesterday and the day before that. But they did look like they came from a different brand and another age. I think we could say that they maybe harked back to an earlier century. but customers who read certain newspapers might have been aware of Philip Green's lavish lifestyle. But when he's next to Kate Moss, it was in every magazine. So everybody starts to become aware of Philip Green and maybe starts to think, I don't know, does this fit with my perception of Topshop?
Yes, exactly that, Laura, exactly. And I just, the issue wasn't with Kate at all. It was also the fact that became the story, that became the brand. So that's always very dangerous. I mean, there's so many other aspects to building a brand and to managing a brand. And that was really what happened, that the focus, I mean, that was just one small collection, tiny part of, the whole of Topshop. So the eye was off the ball. All of the energy and focus and everything was focused into the Kate Moss collaboration, and the rest of the brand suffered from lack of investment in a number of things. But we saw. I mean, Jane very quickly, and it's been reported. We were always thinking we needed to move on because our principles and his principles were very different. We're not ever going to be aligned, and it just. Yeah, we had done the job that we set out to do, and it was time to move on. So that's what happened, and I think that's why the news this week. I mean, I didn't even blink an eye, to be honest. It was so unsurprising for me because the damage was laid out back then. And unfortunately, and I feel I do want to say on this, talking about the brand, but I feel huge sympathy for all of those employees who are faced with that news this week, because the store staff are absolutely the heartbeat of a brand like Topshop and any of those retail brands. And I think that's really the crying shame. It's the responsibility that you owe to those people, and in terms of, I've no doubt, they are so committed to a brand like that.
So, I mean, was the writing on the wall, in a sense, in 2005, I think it was, when Philip Green paid himself, I think it was 1.2 billion dividend, which was then a record, I understand, in British corporate history. And it was about four times Topshop's annual profit. So it wasn't, you couldn't say it was justified in any way, really. But
it was a lot more than four times the annual profit. I'll tell you that. But yes. So I was there. I was in the room. I witnessed the entire charade. And So way back then, we had basically a message to say that Philip had some announcement to make, and could we make our way to the cafeteria at 10 o'clock in the morning in Colgrave House, where it's the Arcadia headquarters, which is, if you could imagine, it's this sort of BHS-style cafeteria. And anyway, it was all kind of decked out in white tablecloths and whatever else, and trays of champagne. And we were like, what's this all about? So basically, it was an announcement. Philip was congratulating himself for paying himself £1.2 billion. Pounds of dividend, and particularly congratulating his wife, who basically everything was in her name, Tina. So
for tax reasons,
so we all had to stand around and applause and just say congratulations, well done. But it was the biggest dividend payout in the history. I don't know, in the history of business, any brand, any retail, certainly any retailer. I think, again, that it was the public nature of that. I mean, however, about, what you think about doing that, but the public nature of that, of again, it doesn't help. Doesn't help when you're trying to actually manage a brand like that, because, when I walked back to my desk from that announcement, literally the phone was hopping. And so you could imagine any other sort of negotiation that you might be making in terms of, be it sponsoring a young designer and saying, "I'm really sorry, we don't have any more budget than that." You know, it becomes very difficult. And our budgets were actually relatively small, but you wouldn't think it by picking up the newspaper and reading about his lifestyle, obviously. And again, prior to him being involved in the business, we were never like that.
So the situation was unsustainable, as you were saying earlier, and Jane left in 2006, and you followed shortly after. Yes. Tell us about what you did next.
So what we did next, I think at that point, I mean, all of the Topshop team, actually, we all left. Jane first and then me and then pretty much everybody else. Because we just, you know what, we were very much, I mean, one of the reasons why it was successful as well was because of the team, just in terms of working together, in terms of actually respecting each other, having a vision and all aspects of the brand, working towards it, be it whether you're in retail, whether you're in marketing, you know, in terms of whatever you're a buyer, whether you're a designer. And if everybody's working towards the same direction, you know, you can get unbelievable results. And I think that was really what we had as a team. So we all left and said, okay, why don't we try and do Topshop somewhere else? But so basically we had the opportunity to take on Whistles, which was part of the Mosaic Group at the time, and basically set about reinventing that brand in terms of actually making it more relevant. Again, it had lost its kind of way in terms of the customer base, and it was a lot smaller than Topshop, so it was a lot more attractive to us in terms of the supply chain, in terms of really making sure you can manage that very closely and being responsible for every aspect of that. So we took that on, but you know, that was that 2008 recession hit, which was challenging times. But, you know, again, just great experience to work on brands like that. You know, so and again, it's about working with people who have a similar mindset, like-minded mindset. It's so important in business. It's so important in building any brand. It's very difficult when the person that you work for, the person, the brand owner, just doesn't get it. I mean, I will tell one little story that maybe sums up the unique difference from where we were coming from, our place, which was all about the customer, putting the customers first in terms of never underestimating the customer, never underestimating that person in terms of how design savvy they are or how what they have to say about a product. And if they don't like it, change it, make it better. However, Philip had a very different philosophy. I'll never forget my very first encounter. And again, we had held off that meeting. We let him focus on all the other brands before he got around to us. But we had a meeting with Philip, and he basically, you know, retail speak is very much about, you know, what are your best sellers? What's your best sellers? What are your worst sellers? You know, it's kind of an opening gambit. But anyway, he was desperate to tell us about his best sellers in BHS. So anyway, he was very proudly retold the story about how his best seller was basically a 4-pack of Belgian beer. And basically, because he loved getting kind of his Christmas stock in the summer, so he'd start Christmas in September. So one of his things that he had was this pack of 4 bottles of Belgian beer. And he said to me, I'm not going to take off his accent, but you can imagine. Anyway, he said to me, yeah, because I've got this, you know, 4 bottles of beer here. And he said, well, what I do is I put a different label on each one, and then I fill it up with the same beer. And they love it. They absolutely love it. And I just remember going, oh my God. Like, I mean, I was just like, you know, you sometimes are suspicious of these things, and you kind of imagine, okay, is that, you know, the kind of retailer he might be? But not only those retailers can't be, it was what he was proud of it. And we were just absolutely, you know, that really kind of set the agenda, set the tone of how things would be.
And when you were at Whistles and then later on still, and you saw how Topshop was faring and indeed how the other parts of Arcadia were faring, what did you think then?
So, you know, I think the thing is, when you're building a brand and you have a kind of a brand life cycle, a product life cycle, you know, and what normally happens is it takes, you know, you might start kind of in the low end of the curve, and then it, you know, it spends a lot of years trying to kind of get it to perform. And then when you do that, you know, you can ride high for a good few years. You can basically, you know, stay going and actually be quite profitable and sort of kind of plateau a little bit for a few years. But then very quickly, if you don't continue to invest or continue to innovate or continue to pioneer and bring in newness or whatever, then you're going to just suddenly nosedive. So I think they had a false sense of security. So I think around when I left, certainly for a couple of years, it was still good. There was expansion plans. I mean, again, the Kate Moss collaboration, you know, Philip used that as this kind of international strategy to open doors. But again, it's very dangerous if you're only known to be associated with celebrity. It's, you know, there's a lot riding on that. So it was the other elements that were very much neglected. I mean, Philip, you know, it's been widely kind of documented, you know, is personally, is he's a bit of a technophobe. But really, it was just about the investment there. So you know, one of the things that when I was involved, we were all about pioneering digital marketing ideas. We were one of the first people to have a podcast, for example, and certainly the website, when we took it on, it was non-existent, and it was, you know, by far and away the biggest store by the time I had left. But it really needed much more developed in terms of systems. I mean, and retail systems are so important. And that investment wasn't there. And I just think the brand, you know, the brand needs constant nurturing, and they needed to innovate constantly in terms of the competition is huge. And there's so many trends and stuff that are happening. I mean, I think the one thing about the loyal customer base that Topshop had developed, you know, that customer has moved on, has grown up, and there's a lot of new customers coming through. And the great thing about, I think, retail at the moment is that the consumers finally are actually, they want more. I mean, they want sustainable brands. They want to know where things are made. They want to be proud of the products they buy. And again, I mean, but that could have been a huge opportunity for someone like Topshop to have been moved into that space early on and to set the example for the industry, you know? So I just think there's lots of things that could have been done, but I've no doubt, you know, retail is, you know, it is under threat everywhere. And I think, I certainly think a lot of, you know, what the news of last week is not something that's happened in the last 6 months. It's been happening in the last 10 years, and the lack of investment really goes to show.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a bit more about online in a moment, but just, I suppose, the actual fashion, the actual stock. I mean, I always kind of, I was starting to get the sense, you know, in the last 5-6 years that it was kind of going off the boil a little bit, but then I wasn't sure, was this just me aging out of the brand in a way that would have happened anyway? It seemed that fashion as a whole, high street fashion, changed and maybe became less feverish and had more, you know, athleisure, loungewear. And when Topshop was doing that, it wasn't doing that in a kind of a convincing way, or not as convincing as its competition.
Yeah, I think that's quite right, Laura. I think, I think certainly, you know, in terms of when we were managing the brand, you know, it was the high street was kind of at its pinnacle in a different way, and certainly in the last few years that has changed. But what I noticed is that, you know, again, one of the things that Philip did in the first, pretty much in the first few hours of taking office, was he sent out a memo everywhere for suppliers to reduce their margin by a certain percentage with immediate effect. So just by him being in charge just meant that he wanted to squeeze the suppliers. And, you know, and he wanted to send a message to them that, you know, we're not going to be messed with, type of thing. Really, that has a knock-on effect. And that means that you're squeezing the margin. And obviously, you've got to negotiate a good deal for yourself, but squeezing the margin, that has impact either in terms of the quality, you know, which is something that I certainly kind of saw over the last few years, but also in terms of just subcontracting and suppliers becoming under increased pressure. And then, as you say, there was huge, you know, trends are changing all the time, and in terms of just, you know, leisure wear, particularly at the moment. But I would again see that's where a brand can always be relevant. And I think, you know, again, I spoke about when we started with Topshop in the beginning, you know, it was still the same name. And that was one of the things that Jane said. She goes, oh, it's such a terrible name. Can we change the name? I mean, Topshop, how bad is that? Honestly. And I was like, well, you know what? It doesn't really matter. In the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you're called. It's actually what you stand for. That's what matters. And I think just like that, you know, so yeah, maybe, you know, a lot of these high street stores are redundant, or maybe their original formats were redundant. Maybe the customers want something different. But that doesn't mean that you can't give the customer something different. That doesn't mean that you can't, you know, innovate and come up with amazing leisure wear line or you know, whatever it is in terms of, because at the time, as you remember, Laura, you were saying you were shopping in Topshop Unique, but also we had another thing called Boutique, which was like, we had lots of secondhand vintage stores within our stores. We had, you know, you'd something for everybody. And it was all about just bringing that customer in and giving them what they want. And, you know, even sustainable fashion, I know this like token organic t-shirts. I mean, that doesn't really cut it for me. There's so much more you could do in that, you know, and by bringing your customer with you and vice versa, you know, I just think you can create, and I know from working there, we were able to create a lot of different lines, a lot of different collections that you'd never imagine that a brand like Topshop at that time could have done. So I don't know whether I'm answering your question, but I think that's, you know, I think it is possible today. Challenging, but possible.
So we're here now in December 2020, and the administrators, as I said at the start, are looking for a buyer for parts of Arcadia, maybe not the whole group, but Topshop is still seen as the strongest part of it and the jewel within Arcadia. But one of the suitors or potential buyers is Boohoo, which is an online-only company, and the companies that they've bought, the retailers that they've snapped up in the last couple of years, they've only wanted their online operations. And as well as being sort of absolutely tragic for all the staff, employees involved, do you think that would be underselling, you know, the power of Topshop in a way? Do you think Topshop should still be there on the high street in some way?
Well, it's a good question and it's a hard one to answer. I think it's pretty well documented, and I think the feeling is that certainly, obviously, in terms of the move towards e-commerce is something which is just going to increase. I think there's a huge growth, and obviously with COVID, as we know, that's totally accelerated that in terms of e-commerce sales. So I think any brand, that's a must to start with. I think any brand needs to kind of absolutely have that as their number one priority. And I think the bricks and mortar is secondary. And I would say that, you know, we inherited, I mean, even when we're working in Topshop, and the same with Whistles, we went on to that, you know, we inherited a lot of stores that maybe weren't right. They just weren't right for us. Maybe those deals, you know, a lot of legacy deals that either the store didn't reflect your customer base or didn't, you know, it may be. So I think one of the things is that it's really important, whatever your brand strategy is, that your distribution strategy matches that consumer target that you're focusing on. And, you know, so I think if it was Boohoo that took it over or whoever it is, you know, they would need to look at it working for their customer. And so that might mean tweaking it. That might mean that certain doors may not be right and that they would need to get out of those contracts. And it might well mean that some of them are right. And also, I think I've also seen, you know, I mean, I've personally recently been working with a white company, that they started out online, you know, as a brand, and they have gone into bricks and mortar, you know, flagship stores. They just have a few key. They've opened a beautiful one actually in Dublin on Grafton Street, and it was, you know, so they're using that as a way, almost as a showcase for their brand, and so that people are then maybe driven to shop online still, but it's also nice to go and have a look and feel and experience. So I think there's all kinds of things happening out there. I think realistically, to answer your question, I think definitely it's the online. It's actually the data, and it's the customer base that is very valuable for Topshop or for any buyer. And then in terms of those doors, I think. Yeah, I think a lot of them, sadly, very sadly for those employees, but I think a lot of them are probably not right. And I think the really tough pill to swallow for anyone that takes this on, and this is to do with how the state of the business that's been handed over, is that the doors that are there, if they want to keep them, they're probably such a bad state that they have not been refurbished, they have not been, you know, looked after in the way that perhaps, you know, they should be in terms of, so they're probably not up to standard, and they're going to end up costing even a lot more money other than their rents. So that's going to be, yeah, it's going to be a tough negotiation.
How do you think Philip Green is feeling this week?
Well, I really can't comment on how he is feeling. The thing with Philip was, you know, the thing I never really understood, when he bought Top Shot, or when he bought Arcadia, excuse me, it was a house of brands, and those brands were, you know, Dorothy Perkins, Burton's, Miss Selfridge, Evans, Wallace, I think it was Warehouse might have been part of it, I can't really remember, but Top Shop, Top Man. And, you know, I'm sure it doesn't take a genius to work out. I think some of the other brands really needed immediate attention. And that I would have thought he would have been really happy with the fact that he has Top Shop, and, you know, Top Shop certainly was on this trajectory of success, and the profit was just, you know, was doubling year on year. And that surely he should have been delighted and just left that alone and focus his efforts on trying to revitalize the other brands. But in some ways he was actually seemed to be quite jealous. He was actually kind of jealous of his own brand doing well because he wasn't actually part of it. And he couldn't be part of it. So he would get quite wounded if we were doing something without him, or if he didn't know about something, or he wasn't front and central of something. So that's sort of very much his kind of personality that so I would imagine in this situation that he is probably not, his thoughts are probably not where they should be, which is with those employees who have been let down, that he is probably licking his wounds from his yacht somewhere. But I would hope that maybe with the demise of BHS that he's kind of learned from that, and that he would, you know, do everything that his family can do in terms of financially to make sure that those employees do get their pensions, and that they... you know, are looked after in this situation.
It is a sad story as well as a fascinating one. And I would just like to join you, echo your sentiments earlier in wishing the best of luck to Arcadia's employees in what is a very difficult time for them at an important time of year. I'm sure many of the customers will look back on fondly on Topshop, you know, whatever happens next, wherever the future lies for the brand. And it was obviously a very important part of your life.
I mean, I think personally, you know, it's when you work very closely in a brand, you actually become very attached. It's not like a business. It's something that it's a passion. I mean, those years there were just most enjoyable of my career, and we had great fun, and it was all about that. And you know, success breeds success, and creativity breeds creativity, and creating a fun environment. I mean, if you were to speak to any employee that worked there at the time, they loved it. Everybody wanted to work for Topshop. That every girl in fashion wanted to work at Topshop, and that was really infectious. And I think that's what's sad. You know, what's really sad is that is lost. And I hope with all of this that's not forgotten, because Topshop at the time did a lot of good things. Did a lot of good things for the industry. A lot of good things for people starting out in fashion. And I hope, you know, there's no reason. I hope it can enjoy its heyday again. Brands are always reinventing themselves, and so I would wish them every success, and whoever is a lucky buyer.
Well, I just finally I just want to say how excited I was the first time I was in the flagship store on Oxford Street in the year 2000 on a break in London. And it was just incredible how the scale of the place. And as you say, there was so many designer lines, so much up and coming talent on display. It was different than anything I'd ever seen, really, even though, you know, Topshop had a prime spot in my local Blanchardstown Centre by that point. But it was really, just around that time where I sort of that word cool is probably overused, but it's really appropriate, I think, in this. Not that I'm saying I'm cool for shopping in Topshop, but
I'll just leave you with a quote. I mean, I think that the time when we felt, have we done our job, was you know, when we started, obviously it was being cited as being this flop shop, but when there was an article written, and it was the Telegraph wrote it, and the headline was Topshop, once so famously naff, now so famously cool. And we were like, yes, that's great, you know.
Good job there. Well, we will leave it there. But thank you very much for your insight today, for speaking to the podcast. Joe Farrelly, former marketing director of Topshop. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
Coming up, property in the pandemic.
At Davy, we know your well-being should be financial as well as personal. And now, when it's a little more challenging, if you're in a position where you have a pension, it's never been more important to get active. So talk to one of our trusted advisors now, and we can help you find a solution for your pension needs. A solution that could help you feel better about your financial future. Let's start the conversation. Call us today or search Davy. Davy, it's not just business, it's personal. Janie Davy, trading as Davy, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. We take our responsibilities personally.
October was the biggest month for mortgage approvals in at least 9 years, with the value of loans surging compared to the same month in 2019. What's behind this growth, and could it lead to inflation in house prices? Here to discuss how the property market is faring in the pandemic is Irish Times personal finance expert Fiona Redden. Fiona, the banking industry body BPFI put out these eye-catching figures this week, but what did they tell us?
That's right, Laura. So mortgage approvals are at a record high at the moment. They're up 20% on the year. And I think it's eye-catching because, of course, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And way back in March, the view was that house prices were not heading for a crash, but were heading for a slump. You know, economists were predicting drops in values of as much as 10, 13%. But now, coming into December, I think prices are down across the country only by about 1% on the year, and a little bit higher in Dublin at about 1.8%. So the crisis hasn't really hit the housing market yet, if ever.
So will it hit it at all now if it's holding up this year?
You'd have to think not. And I guess there's a couple of reasons possibly why it has performed so strongly. I mean, first thing is that the crisis, as we know, it's hit certain sectors of society much harsher than others, those in tourism and hospitality. And if you speak to estate agents, they'll typically say they're our renters. You know, they rent property from us, they don't buy property. So the people who would typically be buyers of property haven't really seen their own financial circumstances hit very much yet. So they're still able to, you know, to make a purchase. The government has also been there trying to incentivise home purchase through Help to Buy. It extended that in the budget. And I guess you could say that that's possibly one of the big reasons behind mortgage approvals in November, is because that came through in October. And it means that you can effectively buy a house for up to 300,000 without pushing down a penny as a deposit yourself.
Because the figures from the BPFI, it did show quite a lot of activity from first-time buyers in particular.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's the Help to Buy, isn't it? Because that gives you 10% of the purchase price up to 30,000. So that's a big decision. I mean, if you've been sitting at home in a flat share maybe, or in a housing share with your people, you know, that you live with, that you're working from home, I'd say a lot of people have started to think, maybe, you know, I want a bit of my own space now. How long will I be working from home for? It's not really the ideal situation. My rent is probably very expensive, and now I can buy a house without any savings. So it does look attractive when you look at it from that, doesn't it?
So it was a kind of a stunning bounce back, but you know, compared to the stalling we saw earlier in the year, or if you combine those two, I believe we're still down compared to 2019 for the whole first period of the year.
Yeah, I mean, house prices are down, yeah, about 1% across the country. But, I mean, that's, you know, it's not down by very much, is it? Not compared to what was expected. When you consider that almost 40% unemployed at one point during the year.
And the volume of loans, of course, is down as well. I mean, there is still, you know, major affordability hurdles for many would-be buyers out there.
Well, that's the thing, Laura. I mean, you can see mortgage approval, so people are going to the bank, they're getting the approval. But will they be able to actually transact and purchase a home? I think that's a whole other issue for people. Because as we know, new construction has fallen this year, you know, with the impact of the pandemic. And the supply of secondhand homes is down substantially, especially in bigger cities like Dublin. So that's going to make it very difficult for people, mortgage approval or not, you know, to be able to actually afford to buy the house that they want. Because what you're finding already is that you have more people chasing fewer homes. And of course, that's keeping the prices, you know, if not growing, then it's keeping the prices up.
Supply of new properties, you know, it hasn't been helped by the pandemic, but is it likely to stay weak next year, do you think?
Yeah, Laura, I think that'll depend on confidence to a certain extent, because you have people who maybe postpone the decision to buy a new house to trade up themselves because they're hoping to get the best price for their own house. And then if they do want to trade up, they're going to have to get a mortgage. Now, I know mortgage approvals are up, but it's still tricky, and particularly depending on which sector you're in, as to whether or not you're going to get that approval. And not only will you get approval, some people need exemptions to make it worth their while in trading up. So I think if the mortgage market loosens up, then that'll feed into supply as well, and maybe loosen some of the supply there and people trading up, which will create more homes for first time buyers in a sense.
Yes, I mean, first-time buyers are often the most frustrated segment of the market, or maybe we should call them would-be first-time buyers, potential first-time buyers. And one of the things they're frustrated by is the central bank's lending rules. But there's no sign of these loosening up, is there?
No, and I mean, they came out, wasn't it, last week and said, no, they're happy with the way they are. Effectively, they mean you can only borrow 3.5 times your income, and you can only borrow 90% of the purchase price unless you can qualify for an exemption. And typically, I mean, I always think that these rules are a bit unfair towards lower income buyers, because, you know, 40,000, what's 3.5 times that? If you're in a large city, it's very difficult to purchase a home. Whereas if just because you have a larger salary, the bank thinks you're, or the central bank rather, thinks you're a more secure borrower and will allow you to borrow more, and you're more inclined to get more of an exemption. But they say they're not going to change, and it doesn't look likely that that's going to change. But of course, people have exemptions. So, you know, the banks can allow you to borrow more than 3.5 times your income, up to about 5 times. So if you think you need that, you should really try and talk to your bank about it, because they stopped giving these exemptions earlier in the year. But now the things are looking somewhat brighter. Some of the banks are back offering these exemptions, and they go on a rolling basis. So you have them up until the end of the year, say, for the banks to use their allocation for 2020. So it's actually a very good time now to get in and ask for an exemption, because once we go into January, they'll be back to their 2021 allocations. So they have a little bit of extra capacity there at the moment.
So you wrote recently in the Irish Times that what's happening to the property market to prices is something of a paradox, because of, you know, the spike of unemployment. But and then you explain that obviously there are, as you say, people who are secure in their jobs and haven't been in part of the exposed sectors. But we don't know what's going to happen, do we, in the next 2 to 3 years? There is kind of going to be a kind of a long tail of pain that might spread out from the most exposed sectors to the pandemic to elsewhere. So is that what you mean by saying, well, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen to confidence?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to avoid, Laura, isn't it? I mean, the coffee shop I go to yesterday just said that was their last day because they're just not sure what's going to happen in the new year. Will they have to close down again or just offer takeaway coffee? There's so much uncertainty out there for people. And as I said, that's affecting a certain sector of the market. But as you said, will that ripple through and affect more people? And if it does, and even if it just shakes confidence without even affecting them, then you could see things slow down. But I guess the problem, and it's the chronic problem in the Irish property market, is lack of supply. So no matter what happens in one respect, if your supply demand, if that's imbalanced, it's always going to keep property prices somewhat insulated from what's going on in the broader economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, fingers crossed the construction market will be able to make up for lost time a little bit at some point. But for people who have the option, you know, who maybe have a deposit saved or can somehow, avail of what's on offer, is it possible to say one way or the other if now is a good time to buy your first house?
I think, Laura, when you're buying a home, it's hard to pinpoint a good time, because what's a good time for you is probably your own personal finances as opposed to the broader market. And if it's your home, it's not necessarily an investment. So whether the price is up or down in 6 months' time, if it's your home, I always say I think people should just go for it, you know, within reason, I suppose, within guidelines of your own affordability. But if you're making an investment decision, that's very different.
Okay, well, on that upbeat note, thank you very much, Fiona Redden.
Thank you, Laura.
And that's it for this week's Inside Business. My thanks again to Joe Farrelly and Fiona Redden. Today's podcast was produced by Suzanne Brennan with JJ Vernon on sound. We'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening.